Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Henry Shookman. He is a novelist, poet, journalist, and Zen teacher. He will be teaching at the Mountain Cloud Zen Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've had you on talking about your novel, The Lost City. I didn't know that you were a Zen teacher. Is this a new thing in your life or something you've been practicing for a long time?
Well, I only was recently made a teacher, but I've been a Zen practitioner for a couple of decades.
And so what is Zen? What is Zen Buddhism as opposed to any other kind of Buddhism or any other kind of meditation?
Okay, well, it's a wonderful question. And one answer is that, you know, almost anything you say about it, you soon discover is wrong. So it can't really be pinned down. But outwardly, one can say things like, I mean, yes, it's a form of Buddhism that developed in India. I mean, it was originally called Dhyana Buddhism, meditation Buddhism. And it kind of describes itself as a particular form of Buddhism or a special transmission, they said, outside the scriptures. So it had more of an emphasis on sort of direct experience and less on scriptural study. So it emerged in India at some point. I mean, in its own legendary genealogy, it traces itself right back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And it says that essentially it is a transmission of Shakyamuni Buddha's mind from generation to generation through master student. So again, in this kind of in its own self-generated genealogy, which is partly definitely historically true but also partly not, they think there are 28 generations of teachers in India, and then it moves to China, and where it becomes Chan Buddhism, and that was in about roughly 460 AD. So, you know, it begins with Shakyamuni Buddha, goes through 800 odd years, and then it moves to China, brought there by this famous Indian master called Bodhidharma, who, his story is kind of wonderful. He was told by his teacher that when he was 80 years old, he should leave India and make the long, arduous journey to China by the age of 80 to spread this wonderful Dharma, this wonderful teaching he had. He followed the instructions to the letter, took 3 years getting to India.
To China.
To China. And once he got there, he spent, you might think he would proselytize, let people know he was there, that sort of thing. Not at all. He sat facing a wall for 9 years.
Good heavens.
That's the story. And turned would-be students away. You know, he was reluctant to take people on. And finally, I mean, the legend goes that one very persistent student called Eka, having spent a night standing outside his little cave where he was sitting in a snowstorm, in the morning he cut off his arm, supposedly, and presented it to the master as a pledge of his determination and dedication.
This is my commitment.
Exactly. So then it spends kind of 750 or so years in China as Chan Buddhism, and in the 30s...
So wait a minute, hang on. So there's this student whose arm is cut off, and the guy says, okay, I'll teach you. And then the student is responsible for spreading it all over China?
No, then the student studies with him for the next 30-odd years.
Because Bodhidharma, he lives to be 150 years old?
120. He died 120. There's interesting stories about his death, too. Yeah, so Eka is accepted as a student and becomes his successor. So he's known as the second ancestor in China. And when Bodhidharma dies, here's an interesting thing. He's put in a cave. His body is put in a cave, and a big boulder is rolled into the mouth of the cave. I mean, get this. 2 days later, there's a Chinese official who actually happens to be returning from a trip to India on a road, you know, some distance away from where Bodhidharma has been buried. He meets Bodhidharma walking down the street. He has no idea that Bodhidharma's dead, and they have a little conversation. He notices that Bodhidharma's wearing only one sandal. And the next day, he reaches where the place where Bodhidharma lived. And they all tell him, well, he's dead. He said, no, he's not. I saw him yesterday in such a place. Said, no, he's dead. Look. And they roll the stone out of the mouth of the cave, and lo and behold, he's not there. But
you know,
one sandal.
That's a familiar story.
Isn't that somehow familiar? Interesting, no?
Isn't it? I suppose one always wonders whether those stories are universal or whether they somehow actually spread from Buddhism to Christianity to whatever.
Well, there's certainly evidence, more and more evidence emerging that there might actually have been, you know, actual links, connections, you know, concrete contact between Mediterranean peoples and Asian peoples in ancient times. There's more and more evidence of that.
Archaeological evidence.
Yeah, they just found a fantastic, amazing discovery of a Roman port in India. This was a port built 100 BC, you know, where thousands of Romans lived. And it was a very big, important port. They actually think it paid for the trade that went through that port may have paid for a quarter of the cost of the Roman army, which was a vast army.
Good heavens.
And so there was a huge, basically a far bigger Roman presence in India in ancient times than it ever was previously suspected. But that aside, I mean, the way I see it really is that these stories of, well, I don't want to be too blasphemous or anything, but of resurrection, you know, or of reference to eternal life and this kind of thing, I mean, they are actually talking about a human experience, I think, you know, which we don't have beyond the grave. We have it now, you know, and this is actually probably something very similar to this mind of Shakyamuni Buddha that Zen purports to transmit from generation to generation.
So explain the analogy between our experience of mind in the here and now and resurrection, where the rock rolls away and the guy's not there.
Okay, well, I don't know about the missing body. I'm not sure about that part. But the idea that there might be some kind of existence that is not, let's say, limited by life and death. Maybe I could put it like that. Now, I've got to say right now that I don't really consider myself a religious person. And I don't personally consider Zen Buddhism a religion. Some might do. I see it as a very profound existential inquiry. And the idea is that it provides a framework in which we can each go on the deepest possible quest, which is to find out who we are. And in the process of that, we make a lot of very surprising discoveries about our version of reality. And we discover more and more aspects of reality that are sort of greater than the three-dimensional view of reality that we live with. And these are not, I don't see these as religious truths, although many might. But I think they're very consistent actually with the findings of contemporary quantum mechanics and things like that, quantum dynamics. Anyway, I think what happens in Zen, one of the main thrusts of Zen training is to free us from our continual conceptual chatter. So if that dies down, you know, it's actually that constant sort of ticker tape of thinking that goes on, both consciously and subliminally, is sort of where our concepts of how reality is are sort of sustained. And when that goes away, or when that drops away suddenly, as it usually is a sort of sudden moment, and Zen has an emphasis on suddenness, you know, we can find extraordinary things, like maybe life and death are just concepts, for example. Maybe we don't have any idea what is going on. Here we are, we're sitting talking to each other.
I think it's quite clear that we have no idea what's going on.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, you're already there. You don't need Zen training. I mean, really, we don't know what on earth is going on. We don't know. We say we were born in such and such a year. But, you know, we don't know what that means. We don't know what it is to be human. We get a very entrenched idea of I, me, mine. This is I am in this body. And that carries with it a whole lot of conceptual associations and conceptual structures. But through our relatively simple practice, actually, of just sitting, I mean, and we can talk more about what we actually do while we're sitting. Yeah. But we do basically just sit in Zen, sit still and silently. It's remarkable, really, that through just doing that for a, you know, half an hour, 2 hours a day, whatever we choose, we can actually drop an extraordinary, a whole sort of world that we've built up, and find a very different kind of consciousness or livingness or existence. I don't know, but even existence isn't the right word. There is no word actually for it, really.
We're talking to Zen teacher and writer Henry Shukman. Now, you used the term a moment ago, to be what it is to be human. And, I mean, I think the part of our humanness that many of us are in touch with is what it is to be a primate, to be a vertebrate, to be a human animal who loves, who experiences insecurity and violence and childbirth and death and all of those things. And I mean, I think as we live, we are inevitably in touch with our animal nature, and we experience pain, and we experience disease and healing or not healing and all those things. Is there a humanness that is above and beyond those things and distinct from those things?
You know, it is a great question. Not distinct from, and yet somehow different. I think they can be perceived in a very different way. And that, again, is another of the purposes of Zen training. I mean, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, after his great enlightenment, said that he'd made this amazing discovery, and it was the resolution of suffering. You know, and then his first teaching was about the Four Noble Truths, which sort of outline a kind of map of how a human being can suffer less, much, much less. But having said that, it doesn't mean that we sort of get rid of our humanity and become less human, or, you know, or beyond human. It's not transcendent. Zen is definitely not a transcendent way, as some religions and practices are. It's totally about being here and now in your body, experiencing what you experience, including worry and anxiety and fear and depression and loss and misery. All those human things, we don't want them to stop at all. But when, I mean, one way to look at it, sort of, again, sort of more from the outside than the inside, as it were, as a sort of observer describing what's going on, is that when this notion of the self, and it is only a notion, has gone, and it's not easy, at all easy, to rid ourselves of it, or to be freed of it, or to see through it. But when we've once really totally seen through it, and seen through this world that it has constructed, suffering is really different. It really is. It feels.
Is that something you've experienced firsthand?
Well, I wouldn't really be able to sort of guide people in it if I hadn't, you know. So I suppose in a sense I have to say yes. Don't particularly want to.
No, but I mean
yes, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure many of us have had intimations of this. I when I was 19, I'd actually written my first book, and I suddenly had an extraordinary experience, you know, that made absolutely no sense, and yet was incredibly authoritative to me. You know, I knew I'd just perceived some very fundamental truth about the way things were. And I think that's actually what initially, I mean, it set me on the path of being a writer. I thought, this is why I must be a writer, kind of thing. And then years later, I began to realize that, no, it wasn't enough just to be a writer. I needed to actually find somebody who could help me with whatever that strange moment had been. And I think there's a lot of people who have sudden intimations.
Can you describe that? Is it something you wanted or want to or can describe? What happened when you were 19?
Yeah, I mean, it was long enough ago that I think I can. Well, basically, I was standing on a beach looking out over the sea as the sun went down, and suddenly what I was looking at wasn't outside me. Suddenly, everything, I was just the same as everything. I was made of the fabric that everything was made of. That's what it felt like. And, of course, the sense of as a half Jew growing up in the 70s in England, belongingness had been quite a big issue for me. You know, that I didn't really belong in a Jewish community because my mum was English, and I didn't really belong in the kind of middle class English world where I lived because I was Jewish, you know. And I always was kind of concerned about, well, where do I belong? How do I belong? And then this moment happened, and all of a sudden, I belonged on this earth in an unimaginably sort of profound and coherent way, because I was actually the same as it.
You know what that makes me think of? It's like a memory of being in the womb, where you're continuous with everything.
That's beautiful. I mean, I think maybe it is. Of course, I wouldn't really think of it exactly as a sort of flashback to the womb or something like that. Because I do think that, I mean, as we go through Zen training, we discover more and more and more about, you know, what we call the Buddha Dharma or Buddha nature or essential nature, which has lots of remarkable aspects, one of which is that sense of being completely one with everything. But it's not the only one. And we discover more and more and more. But, I mean, the point isn't to, as I said earlier, actually, and you were asking, it's not about some sort of transcendent thing where you've escaped the sort of, you know, the prison of the body and the mind or something. They are absolutely part and parcel of who we are. You know, it's not an escapist thing at all. And yet, at the same time, we would have to acknowledge that some kind of attachment that we had to some old identity does seem to drop away. And we discover there's a different kind of identity that we have that includes that completely and is also that entirely and yet is more universal, you know.
And is it identity or is it precisely non-identity?
That's a great, yeah, like you ask such good questions, boy. Yeah, I mean, maybe a better way of putting it is this, that the sense of being a separate self is actually itself a process of identification with certain thoughts and certain feelings and emotions that arise. We say, you know, I feel a certain way, that's me, you know, or I think a certain thought, that's me. We're constantly applying this identification to them. So when that process is interrupted enough and eventually kind of seems to drop away, there is a kind of identification that starts to happen with everything else. I mean, one way, Dogen, the great Japanese master, actually, I never got to this, but he's credited.
We haven't finished our chronology.
Exactly, and our journey.
Yes.
Forever further east, that he brought Chan Buddhism to Japan. I mean, again, this is in the self-created sort of legendary history. In fact, Buddhism had been moving into Japan for 300 years by then. But in 12...
India, China, Japan.
That's right. Dhyana, Chan, Zen. It's just translations of the same word.
Yeah.
But Dogen said something like, when the self... I'm sorry, I haven't got the quote right here, actually. But he said, when the self brings itself forward and affirms things, that's delusion. But when the myriad things... All this world come forward and confirm the self, that's enlightenment. So this sudden sort of space has opened up where the self has gone, and suddenly the whole world just is born again in a totally different way. I mean,
I think when you speak about these things, I think about the vicissitudes of one's daily life in the culture in which we live. So, for example, there's a lot of things that make us separate from each other. I own my house. I pay my taxes. I don't own your house, and I don't pay your taxes, nor you mine. I've got my dog, and it's my dog, and if somebody steals it, I try to get it back. And, like, you know, all these kinds of things. And you have your job, and you make your money, and you have your kids and all this stuff. And when you think about the phenomena that might give rise to a different experience of life, like you had being on the ocean by yourself, mm-hmm. How often does that happen? How often are we in a place that is not owned by one person, let's say, you know, non-commercial, public, natural, free space where there's scope for imagination.
Well, that's yeah. I mean, actually, it seems that when people do have these kinds of intimations or epiphanies, often it is in nature. That's one arena where it often happens. But, I mean, in terms of Zen, it makes absolutely no difference. I mean, there's a famous poem by a 9th century Zen master called Yoko Daishi called the Shodoka, or the Song on Realizing the Way. And he explicitly says, you know, if you think you need to go and sit in a hut in the mountains, you haven't got it. If unless you're fine on the busiest city street, you won't be fine up in the hut, you know. And it's, honestly, it's absolutely true. I mean, I remember one time early on in my training, I was on assignment in Scotland, actually, and I was driving a rental car, so somebody else's car, into Glasgow Airport, nothing to do with me, you know, down a slip road off the motorway. And all of a sudden, I had a very, I mean, absolutely sort of a really overwhelming, you know, moment of discovery about the nature of things, the true nature of things. And it was in the midst of total ordinary workaday. I mean, that's how we want it as well. The line that I'm a teacher in is called the Sambo Kyodan, which was founded in the 40s in Japan. And it's always been a lay line. I mean, we're not monastics hiding away, or I don't mean a diss.
A lay line.
I mean, well, lay with an A.
Right, lay, yeah. Lay as in a layman, yeah. Not an order of priests.
That's right, not or monastics.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, our abbot right now, for example, is a very, very powerful, deep, clear Zen master, is chairman of a company making office furniture. You know, and all our—I mean, typically all
our—does he treat his employees well?
I hope so.
Seriously,
I think so. I think so. He seems very concerned.
Because I mean, without that, to me, no practice is worth anything if it doesn't make you a kinder, better person that is better to other people and the world around you.
I couldn't agree more. And the whole point, actually, is exactly that. I mean, we go on this existential journey that I was talking about earlier. But it has a kind of conclusion. You know, it does have it. Well, maybe it doesn't have a conclusion, but there's a certain place that we hope we'll end up, after which we can kind of set it aside and live our lives in the most helpful way we can. That's really the purpose of Zen training, is exactly that. But we don't really, is to be a helpful kind of person, and it happens by itself.
Exactly.
We don't have to deliberately do it.
Well, and that's the thing about... My own experience of kind of, let's say, East versus West is in the Christian tradition, they say, be a better person. In the Buddhist tradition, they say, meditate, and then naturally you become a better person.
That's right.
And it's interesting how that happens. And it does, I mean, some of these techniques do actually seem to work.
Well, Zen's been around for 2,500 years, and it has apparently been working.
Well, Christianity's been around for 2,000 years, and
has it been working?
Question mark.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, we would say, of course, that you do need to really do this existential work. You need to find out who you really are, and out of that, everything will follow. You know, and if you don't do that. Yeah, maybe you will be helpful in some ways, but in some ways you probably won't. You'll probably perpetuate certain patterns of suffering.
We're talking to Zen teacher and writer Henry Shookman. So I do want to talk about what the technique is whereby these existential questions are explored. But I want to go to a question that something you said earlier brought up for me, which is you said, well, it's not a religion. What is a religion? What's the difference? Is it a matter of the difference between faith and firsthand experience, or what's the difference between a religion and the Zen that you practice?
Well, I could put it like this. One thing is that in Zen is not satisfied with a student sort of hearing the right doctrines or something. Zen wants the student to have their own direct experience of this essential reality that we're talking about. It doesn't. It's not satisfied with the student. I mean, there's a famous case, actually, of one student who came to one of these old Indian masters, actually, and said, you know, there's no I, there's no world for such an I. I mean, he started sort of spouting the right things.
Right.
And the master just looked at him and says, you must really experience great enlightenment yourself and thoroughly confirm it through your own mind. You have to discover for yourself who you really are. And so it's an absolutely integrated personal experience, you know, that you then live without even thinking about it. You know, and I think that aspect of it, that it's got to be your own personal experience. It's very personal. You know, it's all about who we each are. It's not, again, it's not this transcendent thing. It's deeply personal. That plus the fact that there are no deities, there's no supernature, you know.
There are in some forms of Buddhism.
Yeah, I know.
Tibetan Buddhism has all kinds of deities.
It certainly does, and they're probably all marvelous. But in Zen, we don't really. I mean, we do talk about Kanzeon, the bodhisattva of compassion. But actually, when you really kind of explore that, we find that Kanzeon, compassion, or Avalokiteshvara, is nothing other than Buddha nature, this true self that we all are.
How would you describe Buddha nature, or how would you describe a person who is manifesting Buddha nature?
Well, there's one master who said that enlightenment is when the difference between the enlightened state and the non-enlightened state has gone. So somebody, I think, probably totally at peace, totally helpful, always figuring out how to help somebody. I mean, you know, the idea really is that we're in a kind of training to be a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is a person or a being whose only concern is the liberation of others. That we and liberation or awakening or enlightenment, salvation, well, we don't usually use that word, but to free people from the delusion that causes all the pain.
What is the nature of that delusion that causes all the pain?
Well, one key element of it is the mind of self and other, believing that I'm in here, that there is an I that is fixed, constant, solid inside this body, and there's everything else outside this body.
But you wake up the next morning and that, in fact, still is true.
The point is to see what it really is. The point is not, we don't ever want to get rid of anything in Zen. In fact, the more we explore this great matter of who we really are and what life and death really are, where we come from, where we're going, what are we, what is going on here, the more we explore that and somehow find this incredible resolution to those questions that we can find, the more we have, the more is included, including that self, that illusory self. But we know what it is. We know what it is.
And there's less importance placed on it than there was perhaps before.
That's right. Yeah.
I've heard it said that Buddhist practice is, in many ways, can be thought of as a preparation for death.
Well, I think it's true that we are, every time we sit, we are sort of facing this great fact that we are going to die. And what does that mean? And which obviously instantly brings up the question, what does it mean to be alive? And the question, who am I? What am I? What is going on here? What is human consciousness? I mean, that's why, in a certain way, I sometimes think that what we're trying to do is actually get inside our experience. We want to actually get more deeply into what is actually happening as I sit here talking to you. What is, you know, really deep inside, what is going on? I mean, when I say inside, I mean to really inhabit the experience fully. You see what I mean? I used to be concerned when I was a kid was whether I was really awake. you know, not the question of is this all a dream? You know, it might or might not be. But whether or not it was I 100% awake or was I 25% awake? And how would I ever know? Who could tell me? Who could get inside my head and say, you know, you're on 37%. We can crank that up a bit. You know, how would I ever know? You know, and so that's also inviting this sort of question is what is this consciousness?
Well, when you, let's say you quote unquote wake up a little bit more, and I've actually often wondered whether the term enlightenment is an either or thing. I mean, the few enlightened people and the rest of us not, or whether it's kind of a gradual thing where everybody has little moments of it here and there. Or a lot of people have little moments of it here and there. And that doesn't mean, I mean, if I've had that experience, that doesn't mean I'm an enlightened master, because Lord knows I'm not. But in this question of am I awake or not, let's say you wake up a little bit more than you were yesterday or 5 minutes ago. What is your sensory and mental experience like? How is it different?
Wow, it's totally different. But here's the
thing.
Give
me an example. Like, okay, we're sitting here in the baking company. Yeah. The walls are yellow. It smells like bacon. There's all these people around.
Right.
You wake up a little bit. How is it any different?
Well, you know, they say that we're constantly receiving 80,000 bits of sensory information, but we're actually processing about 300.
Right.
Something like that.
Per second or something like that.
Whatever it is, exactly. But look, here's the thing is that people, you're absolutely right, people have these moments of awakening. I'm sure lots and lots of people do. That suddenly they sort of, they see time and space and everything totally differently. You know, they may have this experience that they're kind of one with everything, or they may experience that there's actually nothing at all, that the nature of reality, it's so different that it's not even there the way they thought. Whatever. People have these kinds of sudden moments, for sure. But what the difference is, what do you do with it, really? You know,
No, but wait, but forget about what you do with it. How is your experience at that moment different? I mean, is it that what you described in the watching the sunset, that kind of universal thing?
That's one aspect of it. There are many aspects of it. You know, there's a story about the blind man with an elephant.
Right, he's touching the elephant.
The trunk, the ear, the leg,
right.
The side. They all think, they all describe it in different ways.
Yeah, an elephant is tubular. No, an elephant is like a paintbrush. No, an elephant is like a hose.
Right. Exactly. It's like that. That you can't, you know, you gradually over time, if you're in a training, you know, you do sort of experience more aspects of it. And it, as I said, at a certain point, it seems possible to... I don't know how to put this. It's like dropping through the floor. It's like passing through the eye of the needle. And things are different after. And it's not it's maybe not so much about what you've seen as what you've integrated. You know, the training that I've trained and continue to train in and that I can offer people is in this sort of traditional form of Zen training where we use koans. And each koan is one master's expression of this fabulous reality that, as I said, does not exclude the reality that we're all in and that we've all agreed on. You know, it doesn't exclude that at all, but it does include a bit more. And you can't sort of get a koan with your mind. Your intellect cannot get a koan.
Hang on, let's back up. For our listeners in Radioland, what is a koan?
Okay. Well, many people would have heard some of the famous ones. A koan is a sort of Zen imponderable. Something like, you know the sound of two hands clapping, what is the sound of one hand? That's a very famous one. There's another...
One hand clapping.
Well, it's just really the sound of one hand.
Ah.
Actually. What is the sound of one hand? I mean, how do you even begin to think about that? You can't. You just sit with it. You don't know what it is. You don't know what you're trying to find. It's like you're a blindfold archer in a dark room who has no idea where the target is. You don't know that you're even trying to shoot a target. You don't know what you're doing. But the koan somehow does know. And if you can really just let go of yourself, the koan will suddenly kind of jump in and you'll know what it is. You will just know, and you go to the teacher and you present the koan, which means that you do something that shows your understanding of the koan. And you can't do them unless you've had a moment of awakening. They're just completely impenetrable. They're meant to be.
Right.
Or they just are. It's not really that they're meant to be. They just are. Because they're only discernible, visible. I hesitate to use the word understandable. But they only can express themselves through you if you open up in that way.
Now, let's say, okay, there's some number of extant koans, and people have been trying to, I don't know if the right word is solve them, but sit with them and understand them for millennia. And you're doing one that some other monk did 500 years ago that 10 other monks did 2,000 years ago and so on. Is the answer always the same?
That's one of the fascinating, strange things, that yes, most of them, not all, but most have a traditional presentation that just seems to jump up in you.
So you know there's a book somewhere where all the answers are there in the back.
Well, actually, there was a point in Japan in monasteries that used this training technique where the method did get sort of abused. And senior monks would sell answers to junior monks. In exchange for chores and whatever, you know. But what happened, you see, there are two main lines of Zen that still exist, the Soto and the Rinzai. And broadly speaking, the Soto people don't do as much koan study and the Rinzai people do a lot of it. The line that I'm in, this one, the Sambo Kyodan, was founded in the 40s by two Japanese Soto masters who decided that it's the whole Soto establishment, which is a very large thing in Japan now. You know, lots and lots of temples, mostly doing funerals and births and that sort of thing. You know, they're not really centers of deep spiritual or existential training anymore. And they've decided that they really needed to do something about that, these two. So they reintroduced this Rinzai form, koan training, in their sort of curriculum. And got very, very dedicated to the idea that people must have this experience of really seeing, they call it kensho, you know, seeing your true self. And that once that had happened, they can proceed through 600 or 700 of these koans. So the point is that if you have an opening or awakening or whatever, if you just put it aside, it will kind of basically close itself. It may leave you feeling very strange and uncomfortable, or quite happy, you know, maybe blissed out, whatever, but it will sort of fade. But with koan training, actually, you keep it open, you deepen it, you broaden it, and you clarify it. And then, ultimately, you hope to fully integrate it. And actually, you know, you'll have more as well.
More koans?
No, more awakening.
Right.
More and more and more until finally, you know, it's no longer about, I mean, here's an analogy that one of our abbots used to use, is that it's like a wall of frosted glass that somebody suddenly sees this truth. It's like a hole drilled through that wall.
Yeah.
Every koan they do after that is another little pinprick.
It's funny that you use that analogy, because when I was 27 years old, I sat for the first time at one of those 10-day Vipassana meditation courses. And it was, let's put it this way, it wasn't fun. It was very difficult to sit, and the chattering mind was very chattering. And it was chattering at the end almost as much as it was at the beginning and all of that. And I thought, I have completely failed. And then I went home and I realized that, and what it felt like to me was, I'd been driving with a windshield caked with mud, and that I'd started to clean it off.
Right.
And it wasn't clean, but I could see through it.
Right.
And
beautiful.
That's what it felt like to me.
Well, the idea in this analogy is exactly that. You get more and more holes, and the holes get bigger and bigger, and then eventually the whole sheet of glass has lost all its strength, and it falls down.
Right.
And there's no difference then. You're not seeing something else, you know. You're just living in the midst of it. You know,
right.
It's not a different world.
We're talking to Zen teacher and writer Henry Shukman. So you are teaching. You're teaching an introductory course this Wednesday, May 25th, and then the following two Wednesdays, and people are invited to go to the Mountain Cloud Zen Center and just, I mean, what happens?
Well, we have a weekly sit every Wednesday from 6 to 8:30 p.m., and people are always welcome, you know, newcomers or whatever. And they can stay as long as they like. They can come when they like, actually. We're not too fussy about that. But these particular three coming Wednesdays, I'm going to give a series of talks sort of about introducing people to Zen training, giving a sense of what we do and why we do it, you know. And there'll be a certain amount on the specifics of sort of deportment in a zendo and that sort of thing, and what actually goes on during our periods of sitting, and training in how to begin doing zazen, as we call it, sitting zen, so posture and that sort of thing. But also it'll be talking about what it is that Zen can offer us. You know, I mean, they say there are five kinds of Zen, five main sort of motivations for doing Zen. One is what they call ordinary Zen, which is really doing Zen because it will make you calmer, clearer-minded, better at your work, better at some art or craft or whatever.
Nothing to be sneezed at.
Nothing to be sneezed at. No, that's wonderful. I mean, I think probably most of us start it for something, some reason like that. The second kind they call outside Zen, that simply means meditating within the context of some other tradition, like Christian contemplation or yogic meditation or whatever. The third kind they call Hinayana, lesser vehicle, which is in order to liberate oneself. That means that your motivation is to get clear and liberate it yourself. And then the fourth kind, these are kind of progressively good kinds.
Right.
The fourth kind.
I'm liking the first kind. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you don't lose it.
Yeah.
You don't lose it.
Right,
know?
Right.
And maybe they just naturally evolve one from another, you know. And the fourth kind is Mahayana, doing it to save all beings. And then the fifth kind is sort of totally motivationless. You just do it. Because you know it's the thing to do.
Now, going back to the earlier part of the evolution, I mean, you are a novelist. How do you see the relationship between your fiction work and poetry and your practice?
Well, unquestionably, I think I was, you know, on some kind of existential quest from an early age. And writing seemed to be, to me, a way to explore that and address that. And you know, and it, to a certain extent, it was. I mean, you know, obviously, when you're writing, you know, you're trying to make sense of what is going on around you. You know, whether it's phenomena of all kinds, or human relationships, or whatever. You know, you're trying to make sense of it, and then also, writing is a process of discovery. You know, self-discovery as well. You know, finding out more about who you are. I mean, you can, anyway, as you write. And certain, I think I was probably motivated by that, but at some point, you know, when I don't know, at a certain point, I kind of just felt it wasn't enough. I mean, I didn't stop writing. I still write, but it wasn't direct enough. You know, and I needed to, essentially, I needed to get help. I mean, that's one of the key things in Zen, is that you have to have a teacher. And, you know, my first real teacher, you know, was not a sort of intellectual guy. You know, he ran a charity. But there was just an instant sense of him understanding me in some way that sort of nobody else had, you know. And I wasn't even looking for a teacher. I think that's probably true, that old adage that, when the student's ready, the teacher appears, you know. But in Zen, the whole history of Zen is a history of relationships. And Zen is, among all the other stuff, it's really firing up the relationship channels in our brains. I mean, there's neuroscience now proving this, that long-term meditators, all the compassion circuitry and all the relationship circuitry is much livelier. Because we've just discovered that... through our training, our relationship with a teacher, that it's actually nothing but relationship. Zen doesn't exist outside of this incredible history of relationships.
Now, when they study their brains, are their anger and hostility circuits kind of atrophied?
Probably. I don't actually know enough about it. I wish I could tell you for sure. I mean, certainly, yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence now that kind of the parts you want get more developed and they get more active in long-term meditators.
There's an interesting, another metaphor. I mean, I think we understand so many things through metaphors and often metaphors from nature. Somebody was talking about a student who really tried to push themselves in their practice, and the teacher said, it's like pushing an apple to ripen.
Exactly. You know, there's a famous story about a Zen master. A student comes to him and says, if I practice well, how long will it take me to get enlightened? And he says, 10 years. And then the student says, no, but I'm going to really work hard. Teacher says, 20 years. No, you don't get it. I really, really want this. 30 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Henry Shukman, tell us about the Mountain Cloud Zen Center, which is right here in Santa Fe.
It's an absolutely beautiful zendo built about 25, 30 years ago by a group of students of a Zen teacher called Philip Kaplow Roshi, who wrote a very famous book, or compiled a very famous book, called The Three Pillars of Zen. And he left fairly soon after completing the building, actually. He left town, went back to the East Coast. And the center kind of got rather quiet. And right now, it's a wonderful place that hosts two different Zen groups. We kind of share it. And one is a group that has a teacher who doesn't live in town. He lives in North Carolina and periodically comes, called Sandy Stewart. And the other is our little group, which has been sort of valiantly maintained for 28 years odd by a wonderful guy called Will Brennan, who was one of the original students who came out here with Kaplow Roshi. And so now we've sort of joined, they invited me in, and we're developing our Sangha in wonderful ways, really. Some of the old students of Kaplow.
Sangha meaning community of...
of sitters, yeah. Fellow sitters, you know. And, some of the old students of Kaplow are coming back to sit. And it turns out, actually, that this teacher, Kaplow, was in exactly the same line that I'm in. We have precisely the same...
lineage meaning a chain of teachers going way back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're in exactly the same one, which is kind of a nice little coincidence.
Unusual, right.
Yeah. So we have sitting several times a week. I mean, our little group sits on Mondays in the morning, 6:30 to 8 p.m., 8 a.m., and then Wednesdays, 6 to 8:30 p.m. The other group sits on Monday evening and Friday morning. Once a month, we have what's called a Zazen Kai, which is an all-day sit on the fourth Sunday of each month.
And can people... If they're meditators but not exactly inside of your group, can they show up and just sit?
Oh, totally. We welcome everybody. And we have if somebody comes who's never sat before, we give them a little instruction to help
right.
them with that, you know. And anybody's welcome. And every Wednesday we have a talk by me. But as we said earlier, the next three is going to be these introductory talks. And then actually come later in the summer, we're going to shift to Thursday nights.
Oh, okay.
Just
well,
to let people know.
People can find out more about that by going to mountaincloud.org. Henry Shukman is a novelist, poet, journalist, and Zen teacher. What did the Zen Buddhist say to the hot dog vendor?
I know. Make me one with everything. So you can also contact Will Brennan at rohatsu@hotmail.com. That's R-O-H-A-T-S-U at hotmail.com, or me, henryshukman@gmail.com.
Shukman, S-H-U-K-M-A-N.
Right.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to .foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.